meditation creates a person. The stability of meditation creates a person who can bear suffering very well. Even though, ironically, the developing vulnerability or open-heartedness makes it worse, makes suffering more acute, but the stability is the key. So now, in our world, there's a great deal of suffering. Actually, I'm sure it was always so. But now we know about it. We know about it everywhere. And whenever we read or see the news, we suffer a fresh assault on our consciousness, on our minds. Because all over the world, the innocent, and even the not so innocent, are suffering. And some of them are suffering in our name. But we don't have to go around the world to find hotbeds of suffering. For some of us, we can just go out our door or talk to friends or talk to our clients, depending on what our profession is. All over our country, children are being mistreated or abandoned, and their parents, the positive energy that their parents might have is being snuffed out by despair. At Zen Center, I met a woman who had been a policeman in the South, and she took up Zen practice. She came to Zen Center to practice Zen because when she was a policeman and she would be called on a domestic call, violence between the adults, she would go on the call and there would be children, toddlers, and they didn't register any fear. Their eyes were dead, she said. And the children with dead eyes is what she couldn't bear. Already at 2 or 3, to just have dead eyes, to be numbed over. And this was what drove her to have some sort of practice, some way to deal with the suffering she felt. And when I used to live in the city years ago, whenever I stepped out my door, there were always teenage whores and crack dealers and homeless people, desperation all around me. And most of us, when we think of this kind of suffering, we go numb ourselves. We're like the adult version of the children with dead eyes. We can't stand it, so we blot it out. I've heard of this malady called compassion burnout, where people just, they feel so helpless, we feel so helpless, and there's just always some fresh new crisis. And after a while, you just go numb in order to go on with your life. So this kind of numbness is the near enemy of compassion. The far enemy is indifference. I mean, actually don't care about other people. But the near enemy is this burnout, this helpless feeling. And the result of both the near and far enemy is that you don't feel your compassion. You don't act compassionately. So the world is a little meaner, a little bleaker as a result of both those enemies of compassion. So it's very important that we have some way to resist this energy-draining helplessness that we feel in the face of our own and other people's great suffering all over the world, and the alienation we might feel now in our culture because it is so stridently materialistic. Our culture is very materialistic right now, and so many people I know feel alienated, feel like they have to create their own little world and get away and not participate in our culture right now. But I think that instead of turning away, we must rally ourselves to present a clear and unambiguous alternative to fundamentalism and materialism. I think we must make an energetic and unwavering commitment to creating connection and kindness in a world gone mad and gone numb. So some people protect themselves by not reading the news or by moving to the country to a nice place where they can tend their garden and not pay too much attention to what else is going on, or just concentrate on developing their own talents, their own self-expression in the world. But I think we have to ask ourselves, what kind of life do we want? What do we want our lives to be about? What increases or decreases our energy level? What makes us feel connected? This is an important question, because for many of us, when we're creative, connection is really part of what fires our creativity. And I actually appreciated living in the city, in the neighborhood of the San Francisco Zen Center, which was for many years, a very difficult neighborhood to live in. But I always felt that it was ground zero for suffering, that I was right at ground zero, so I could walk out my door, and no matter how delusional I was or how self-absorbed I was, there it was, right in front of my eyes. I could never stray too far, never resist getting involved with our neighborhood whores, never resist getting involved with the dealers, with the people selling stolen goods. Always right in there. Could never get too far into my own delusions, because there it was in front of my face, and I could rely on it to ground me. So I know it really goes against the grain in our self-absorbed culture right now, our acquisitive culture, to be absorbed or involved with the suffering of strangers. But that involvement does answer some persistent, primal aspect of ourselves, the wish to connect, the wish to connect up. And if you've been sitting or studying Buddhism for some time, then you have had Buddha's original insight that we all are connected. We all are connected up at base. Now, there's plenty of evidence that Americans tend to be kind of small-minded or violent or acquisitive or self-preoccupied, but there's also some evidence to the contrary, like the Oprah Winfrey Show. Now, she's on at a time slot, well, she used to be years ago when I had a TV. She was on, her competition was real sensational, you know, that people might want to watch the shows that were on up against her for some, you know, sensational reason, or to make themselves feel good that no matter how far down they weren't that far down as the guests on the show. But Oprah maintained, and in fact more and more went in the direction of celebrating unsung heroes or neighborhood people like postmen who put aside part of his money to send kids in his neighborhood to college. That kind of thing. So she actually, and I remember when she was being sued by the Cattlemen's Association because she had had people on her show who were against eating meat. And what did she do? She just picked up her show and went down to Texas you know, and took the microphone around on the street and heard people say why they thought that she was endangering their livelihood or why they thought that maybe she was right. And she was just inclusive, absolutely inclusive. So this is evidence that, and still remained very popular with her audience. So I think that people are also, in addition to being small-minded and acquisitive, also very interested in other people. So tonight, I'd like to talk about how we maintain interest and connection and joy and lots of energy for our practice in the midst of despair and meanness and all the rancor going on between people. I think this is very important. Very important. As I said, to present some alternative, some unambiguous alternative to fundamentalism and materialism. But you have to have a lot of energy to do this. So how do we maintain our energy? There's very little reinforcement in our culture now for what we're doing, what you're doing here tonight, coming and sitting for 40 minutes, which doesn't get you anywhere. Just coming and sitting. And hopefully volunteering for some of the activities that were offered for volunteering. Just doing things for other people and noticing how it makes you feel. So this is the opposite of the message that we get from TV. Once a week I watch TV at the place where I stay in the city, and I'm just fascinated. Just fascinated. I love reality shows. They're my favorite because they're like little labs of suffering. In the same way that a scientist isolates all the conditions in an experiment. This is exactly what happens in reality shows. All the conditions, a completely contrived situation in which people are motivated to break the precepts. So this is very interesting to watch this. So to get from anguish and depression to a life of compassion and joy, we have to actually do something. And that something is practicing the six paramitas. Paramita means going to the other shore. So I think of it as getting from anguish and desperation to some kind of, some kind of wide view, some kind of expansive feeling. So the paramitas are dana, or giving, which is the one I'm going to talk about tonight. But it's not in the charity sense of writing a check for a cause, which is great. Don't let me discourage you from doing that. But it's more the way I want to talk about dana paramita tonight is more in the realm of developing an attitude of bounty or generosity. So that's one, and then there's precepts or an ethical life, two, patience, which is the antidote to anger and self-entitlement. And any of these are fascinating to do as a practice. Perseverance, which is virya, energy, kind of borders on what we're talking about tonight, but all the paramitas dovetail into each other. So what we're talking about tonight dovetails into energy, virya, perseverance. And then meditation, samadhi, wisdom, understanding. So the practice of dana paramita, as I'm going to talk about it tonight, is basically just stepping into the flow. Just stepping into the flow of life. This is breath-based. So when you look at your life from the point of view of your breath, that's a good definition of dana paramita, actually. Because when you breathe in and breathe out, it's pretty chaotic. Since you're relying on your breath or abiding in your breath as opposed to concepts. We use concepts to make everything orderly so we can find our way to the bathroom and stuff like that. But when you look at your life from the point of view of breath, it all just flows into each other. Things don't stop at edges. Edges are pretty much conceptual. So a perceptual flow in which you don't break up your experience into giving or taking or anything like that. You get that reality is about flow. And you know that any separating out you do or dividing up you do is just temporary for convenience. Like I say, finding your way to the car, stopping at red lights, red means stop, and things like that. So when you practice dana paramita, there's no giver, receiver, or gift. It's just living. It's just part of the fundamental richness of your direct experience. And it arises from your own feeling of bounty, the richness of your own life. The richness of just being alive. It flows into you, and whatever you have to give just flows out of you. So the way I picture it, it's kind of arbitrary, this is just my image, is all the stuff that nourishes me flows in my back, somehow my back, like money, a place to live, friends, work that I like to do, people brought me 2 cups of tea, I noticed, that flows in, that's the bounty, and then what flows out of me on the other side is money and work that I do, friendliness to others, and the work that I do, talks and sittings and my interpretation of the Dharma. So that's kind of a flow. That's what I mean by the flow. It flows into me as nourishment and sustenance for me and flows out of me in terms of my work. Or even just your complete attention is something that you can give. So giving and receiving are basically the same practice from the point of view of dana paramita. Both are based on the perception of bounty, the richness, the uniqueness of our individual experience. It's just an unbroken flow in and out, in and out. So that's dana paramita, and it's your responsibility if you're going to practice dana paramita to perceive the bounty of your own life circumstances, whatever they are. One of the purposes of a meditation practice is to create a person whose happiness is independent of circumstances. And you become aware of this when you read extraordinary books like Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, who was in Auschwitz and was still, as he looked around him, able to see tremendous kindness. A man who stole a turnip to give to his father for his birthday. He risked his life to steal a turnip to give to his father. And Viktor Frankl abided in this. He sank his eggs into this kindness. There was plenty of other stuff going on, but this was his nourishment. And there's also a book by a Tibetan monk who was in a Chinese prison camp for many years. Same thing, practiced kindness. So it's your responsibility to notice the bounty of your life and to put it into nourishing you so that you can offer. So, already I'm pressed for time. So this is my non-nourishing mode when I get pressed. So I think that I'm going to just cut to some things that I want to say. So although the way I'm describing Dhanaparamita sounds like a very advanced practice, if you can practice it immediately as a beginner. So, for instance, as I said, we can give the gift of our full attention anytime. And a practice that I recommend and still practice, even though I give it to beginners, is phone practice. In other words, the phone rings. Well, first you have to decide whether you're going to answer the phone. You know, whether you're going to have a machine or a service or whatever, or whether you're going to answer your phone. For years and years, I had a machine to answer my phone because I'm too busy to be available. And then finally, the years passed, and I thought, wait a minute. My job is to be available. I'm a Zen priest. That's called being available. So I decided to take the machine off my phone whenever I was home. Now this required that I would be willing to interrupt whatever I was doing, turn toward the ringing phone, breathe deeply, pick it up, and say hello. Totally offer myself to the person. And people aren't used to this. They can be very disturbed by it. Oh! I didn't expect you. Once Jack Kornfield called me. And when I answered the phone, I mean, he was clearly making many calls. And so when I answered the phone, but he immediately came into the present moment and we chatted. And so we hung up. And then he forgot something, so he called me right back and I answered the phone and he said, oh! How could I possibly answer the phone twice in a row? So anyway, this is a great practice. A great practice. Just like a tone arm, you just lift yourself off the record and turn toward the phone. Plus, I always reinforce this when it happens to me. If I'm calling a business and a human answers and seems there, I always say, oh, thank you, thank you. Oh, my God, thank you. So I hope that that's nourishing to them. And then another practice of Dhanaparamita for anyone, but a beginner can enter here, is cooking a meal. Like even when I'm throwing something in the microwave, I have a Tara on my kitchen counter and I bow to her three times and I take my food, my ready-made food, put it in the microwave and push the buttons very reverently. And then I set the table and everything. So, and if I'm doing this for someone else, if I'm making a salad or something for members of my family or a guest, we have many guests in my home because it's also a temple. So I'm aware of the fact that this nourishment, the way I treat it, is going to nourish someone else. So at that moment, it's what I'm offering. And so if you cook food for your kids or your family or your roommate, that's Dhanaparamita, to be aware of that, of your offering literal nourishment when you do that. So my first foray into this realm of Dhanaparamita, before I knew the words or anything about it, was when I was a brand new student at the San Francisco Zen Center. And I moved in, and what you don't realize when you move into Zen Center is that you're not going to have any life from then on, because you're expected to do a meal job, a cleanup job, and a house job, and then Then there's just whenever you appear in public, you're asked to help with whatever is going on. So I thought of myself as a generous person, but this was too much. So I used to hide out in my room. And if somebody knocked on my door, I wouldn't answer. I was pretending that I wasn't there. So, and when I would go into public space, I was kind of skitter in and skitter out. So after a while, this bothered me. I mean, because I did think of myself as a generous person before I got to Zen Center. But now it was clear that there was some glitch. So I went to speak to the head of practice. And before I went to see him, since I had an idea of what he would say, I thought in my mind about what I could offer, kind of do a negotiation thing. So I asked him, would it be all right if I did a selfishness practice for a period of time, thinking of me first? And he said, sure, as long as you do your house job and your, you know, your dinner job and your cleanup job and all the what you're supposed to. Oh, there was also a Zendo job, too. We had to clean up the Zendo. So four jobs just before you do anything. So he said, as long as you do that, yes, you can practice selfishness and I will support you. So I started the practice. And whenever anybody asked me would I help with something, I always said no. And whenever anybody served cookies for tea, I always, instead of just taking the one near closest by, which is correct, I would always make them hold the plate while I looked for the big one. And I took that. But first, this was very hard because, of course, the reaction of people was very disapproving. But after a while, I really got into it. And so I passed tremendous tests of my determination to practice selfishness, which I won't go into in the interest of time, but I was put to the test, but I held to it. And I hadn't had any ending date for this practice because I didn't know what was going to happen. So I practiced it for a long time, months. And I didn't think about when it was going to end. In fact, I was very happy with it. I felt myself gradually filling up again. I think what had happened is I became so depleted that I mean just emotionally in some psychic way, that I actually felt the filling. And I didn't know when I was filled again until one time a person just asked me in public space to help them, and without thinking I said yes. And then I noticed that I had said yes. And then I said yes again, and yes again, and yes again, and that the practice was over. I finally got filled, and I noticed that actually, for me, generosity came now from a completely different place than it had before I moved in. Before, it was like a social courtesy. In fact, I remember Trungpa Rinpoche saying in, I think it's Path of a Warrior or something, he says that social courtesy is not generosity. But, you know, when you first read that, you don't know what the alternative is. Anyway, this just spilled out of me. And I wanted it to. I wanted to just spill out onto other people and treat other people the way I had treated myself. And that's what happened with that practice. Completely unexpected. So that was the beginning of my study of Dana Paramita. And even though I didn't know about Dana Paramita or what I was looking at that time, but the subsequent years have been even more interesting in this way. So the next time I noticed a glitch in my generosity was many years later, decades later, and I was a body worker and teaching classes at many hospitals for people with chronic pain. Even as a body worker, I always taught meditation. That's the only thing I know, really. And so I would teach people how to move inside their bodies and base their body, base their lives on the meditation in their bodies to deal with pain. So I was paid well for that, especially in hospitals. This was in the mid-80s. And I mean, when I went into Zen Center in 1970, I said, bye-bye, world. I mean, I was very sorry to leave it, but I thought that's what you had to do to have a meditation practice. It was certainly presented to me that way. But I was very sorry to leave the world. And so, imagine my surprise when 15 years later, people are calling up Zen Center saying, hey, send somebody over here. We need a meditator to teach about chronic pain. So I re-entered the world, and at obscene prices. I mean, it was just amazing to me, having lived a very simple life all that time.